Hi, I'm Father Daniel Duplantis. In the 20th century, a new movement from the Far East captured the Western mind. Since then, the intersection of Christianity and martial arts has generated both conflict and harmony. In between, there remains many gray areas. In my new book, Jesus in the Dojo, I combine timeless theology with modern catechesis to provide a clearer path of reconciliation between the Christian faith and the practice of martial arts. You can find my book, Jesus in the Dojo, available now at most booksellers.
Trigger warning. This podcast addresses deeply rooted and challenging topics. It is written for open-minded individuals who are seeking insight and alternative perspectives on the complex histories of cults and their leaders. Many cults are destructive, and some of the content presented here may be emotionally triggering. This podcast is not recommended for young people, as some content may be inappropriate. Listener discretion advised. Welcome to Cult Following.
Hi, everyone. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Dr. Katie and I are so pleased with the reception the first season of the Cult Following podcast received. We look forward to bringing you more episodes together in the future. But for the next few episodes, it's just going to be me, along with special guest hosts, because Dr. Katie is busy with her practice for a bit. But rest assured, she's looking forward to coming back as soon as she can. Until then, I hope you enjoy the second season of Cult Following.
Well, I thought what would be cool would be to do this joint episode that could air on my Cult Following podcast and on your Karate Priest podcast. So for people that aren't familiar with this whole operation, I produce a whole lot of podcasts. One of them is for Father Dan here, and I do one with Dr. Katie Mooney that is called Cult Following. So we thought this was the perfect way to have a dialogue between a priest and a cult researcher such as myself. So I think to kick this off, let's define cult, because the way I define it in the Cult Following podcast and how cult is defined within the Catholic Church are really very different in a way. So, I'll give people kind of the brief description of what cult is, how it's referred to sort of in pop culture in a way, and maybe even a little bit historically, and that is kind of a small group of people having religious beliefs or practices regarded by others as strange or sinister. So a lot of the definition of a cult really comes down to just sort of public opinion. People are kind of saying, oh, well, that's weird. That must be a cult, when it really may not be at all. And then certainly, of course, we've heard, you know, in the news and in history, these terribly destructive cults that may be Satanists or have been suicide cults. Those are the ones that people hear about forever, such as, Jim Jones in Jonestown or David Koresh in Waco. But you have a different definition of cult, Father Dan. Tell everyone about that.
Yeah, so when we look at the word cult in the Catholic Church, and I think specifically in terms of the way that the Catechism of the Catholic Church is structured, that's the Catechism is the book that's given to us that basically tells us what we believe as Catholics. And so it's divided into three main parts. We call it the three C's: creed, code, and cult. So when we look at it that way, you know, for us, what cult is the ritual worship aspect for us as Catholics, is the liturgy in essence. And so in a sense, like, we would say that there's some, like, you know, cultic aspects to Catholicism in terms of the fact that there's ritual to it. So again, a lot of this is defining our terms really between, like, looking at more like obscure cults, which is really going to be the focus of our discussion today, as opposed to what we say with Catholicism or any organized religion, how there are cultic aspects, we would say like ritual aspects of these organizations, of these religions. So that's kind of where we're coming at today, is really focusing, I think, more on the obscure ones. And maybe to branch off slightly with that is to talk about occult things, which are normally associated with these obscure cults.
Right, right. I noticed that there are kind of four things that both religions and cults provide, and there's a similarity between them, and that is sort of meaning, purpose, community, and ritual. These are the four things that seem to run parallel to one another, whether a person joins an organized religion or a cult. And I think the first question I have for you, Father Dan, is why do you think a person would choose to join a cult over choosing to join a religion?
I think that's going to have a lot to do with, again, those four things, and maybe any of those reasons. Why people would leave a more organized religion for something has to do with finding a particular need from among those four things that you just talked about, whether it be the community aspect. I know people who've left the church for other organizations because they felt more accepted by a different community, or maybe because of a sense of purpose that, you know, they found a perhaps a greater sense of purpose in a cult. So I would say it has a lot to do with that, is in a person's search for meaning, for purpose in life, for, again, for the sense of community. They're trying to fulfill a specific need. And so I would think that perhaps a perceived need being met is what would lead somebody to leave an organized religion for more of a cult.
I often hear the multi-level marketing aspect of cults. Especially cults with deep pockets that have the ability to really heavily market to people. You don't really see an advertisement on television necessarily for the Catholic Church, right? But you might see ads for controversial books that lead someone into a controversial religion or cult. Do you think the marketing aspect is maybe appealing to people in a way?
Perhaps in a way, and in the last decade, there has been some kind of advertisement campaign with Catholicism. A very famous one is called Catholics Come Home. In fact, Lou Holtz, the famous, you know, Notre Dame football coach and now ESPN commentator, was a huge figurehead for the Catholics Come Home movement, which is basically was kind of like an ad campaign to encourage Catholics who had maybe fallen away from the church to come back to the sacraments, to come back to Mass. But that was really about it. Other than that, you don't see a lot of really like Catholic advertisement.
It's a word of mouth operation, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the really for us, I would say for us, you know, in the Catholic Church is to focus really on authentic evangelization.
Yeah.
Is to focus really on the relational aspect of things, you know, and that's actually one of my summer readings right now as I'm reading a book called Forming Intentional Disciples. And the whole concept behind the book is really like relational evangelization. You know, we really shouldn't have to pour a lot of money into advertising. We should meet people where they are, engage them in what they already know, bring them to a level of understanding. And, you know, there's these different thresholds of evangelization. And so like to bring them through the really organic process, if we want to grow the church, which is, you know, obviously what we would want to do. That's what evangelization is. But to do more organically, we shouldn't have to pay people to come into the church, because are they really coming in for the right reasons?
Right,
you know,
right.
We want authentic discipleship. And so that's why in many ways the church doesn't focus on, you know, like ads or anything like that. We want, you know, evangelization, and we want conversion to really be authentic, because we want discipleship to be authentic.
Right. I asked you why a person would choose to join a cult over religion. I'm curious, what do you think is happening in the mind of a person who wants to become a cult leader? How damaged is that person?
Yeah, I'm almost wondering if that's something they really want to do in and of itself, or if it's something they perhaps feel called to do, and whatever that means by being called. You know, I would say certainly, you know, with cult leaders, and you know, we've heard of all kind of crazy situations with things like this. That I think there would. I would love to have these people, you know, have some kind of like psychological evaluation to see exactly like, is there any kind of like schizophrenia or, you know, or things like that? Do they hear voices, you know, perhaps to say that, you know, they felt like they were called by a higher power to start this cult, this organization? Because that's oftentimes what it sounds like is this sense of delusion that maybe they feel called by a higher power, or, you know, or even we hear people who, you know, they commit crimes or they commit certain acts. And when asked, like, why did you do it? They said, you know, there was a voice that told me to do it, you know? So I'm wondering if it would be things like that, if there's a real psychological aspect behind somebody who just one day gets up and says, I'm going to start my own cult.
Now let's break that open a little bit more. I think that's really interesting. You said that, you know, that a voice told them to do it. Well, that voice may not necessarily be the voice of God, right? There's other voices,
right,
that get
yeah.
the people. Let's talk about that. I mean, this is a real thing that, you know, that people are possessed, their demons talk to people. Break into that a little bit more, that aspect of this.
Oh yeah. So then now we're starting to really get into maybe the sense of the occult with that, you know, if it is more of a demonic nature or a spiritual nature, you know, I like to fall back to St. Ignatius of Loyola, who provides what we call rules for the discernment of spirits. And what he means by that is really like, how do we know what's the voice of God and how do we know what's not the voice of God? What could be the voice of the enemy, we would say, whether that be Satan himself or his powers, you know, or his demons. And so it's ways of recognizing, you know, is this something like based on like what we know of God, what we know of the church, what we know of everything that he's given to us through the deposit of faith? Is this something that kind of like checks all the boxes of, yeah, like this makes sense. Like this fits, you know, this fits the Bible. This fits tradition, sacred tradition. You know, this fits the teaching of the church. You know, this sounds like it could be God, you know, or like, you know, if we were to hear a voice that says, you know, do something that would obviously be contrary to the commandments or to the precepts of the church or anything like that, we would say, okay, wait, we need to scrutinize this, you know, because yeah, in many ways, St. Ignatius would say, that Satan or even just the demonic powers themselves could try to talk to us as God would talk to us, you know? And so he's sneaky, you know, Satan's very sneaky sometimes. And so the whole idea is the discernment of how to figure out, is this God talking to me or is this, or is this, you know, some kind of demonic activity, whether it be just temptation, which is the most ordinary form of demonic activity.
Right, right. I find that really interesting. Let me ask you about this. I've been following a couple of, you know, questionable potential cults in this regard, but these faith healer tent assemblies that have been going on for a really long time. You know, is this a gateway to a cult? Is this cultist activity? Is this just theater? Is this just P.T. Barnum? Is it a money grab? What do you think of these people that are faith healers that are getting out of the wheelchair in the tent? You know, are these just all carnies? Is there anything real to this, do you think? I mean, we know miracles have existed in the Catholic Church. Like, could this stuff be real or is this mostly rubbish, do you think? What's your opinion?
I think there could be a degree to which it's real. At the same time, there has to be, like I said, a true sense of discernment. And especially when it comes to things like this, you know, obviously, like we do attribute miracles, especially healing miracles, especially to the intercession of the saints. Many times when we're looking at, you know, miracles to prove that a particular saint is in heaven, you know, we're looking at the canonization process. Most of the miracles associated with the saint's intercession are healing miracles. Now, you know, what kind of maybe would throw me off and where I would put some scrutiny would be like where it's happening. You know, is this someone who's maybe known for a gift of healing? You know, and I think particularly of a particular nun that I've read her book, Sister Breege McKenna, who's known for a very powerful ministry of intercessory prayer and healing, where she's prayed for people and they've received healing. But she always credits it to the Lord. You know, she credits it back to Jesus and to the intercession of the saints. It's never to bring attention to herself. And so when I look at, you know, maybe like the setting of these things, you know, you talk about like tent healers and things like this, you know, like, is this just something that they're kind of going off and doing on their own? And, you know, like, you know, what intercession are they asking for? Are they asking for the intercession of the saints? Are they just kind of maybe doing this on their own power? Which in some cases could then be, you know, could become a cult because they could be, you know, either knowingly or unknowingly invoking demonic powers for the sake of healing. The demons could be using that as a guise to infiltrate then the spiritual lives of the people involved. So again, I think a lot of this has to do with scrutinizing things, but yeah, obviously there are healing miracles. There are healing miracles even on the priesthood side of things where, you know, we give the sacrament of anointing of the sick, which is primarily concerned. Again, it's a sacrament. It's primarily concerned with bestowing grace and the spiritual healing of a person who's ill or dying. But there have been stories that I've heard of there being miraculous physical healings associated with the sacrament as well. So yeah, there is some degree to which, you know, there's truth in healing miracles. But again, this has to really be discerned and scrutinized on a case-by-case basis. But it comes to tent healings and things like that. If it's really like independent of any kind of church authority, it has to be a lot of scrutiny, I would think, because most people are known for spiritual gifts. And they would be recognized and there would be some kind of investigation at least into, you know, the truth of what they're doing.
Sure. Now, in modern day times, when people are looking at miracles being performed, particularly miracles in the Catholic Church, how are the miracles proven? How does that process work? Is it just that there were other people there to witness it? Is there some science behind proving that these things happen? Usually, what's that process generally?
That's another both and. I know in a lot of the podcast episodes and questions we talk about, there's a lot of both ands, and it's all of that, you know. Excuse me. There's usually people who witness to these miracles, you know, and that's how it's even reported to begin with. On top of that, there is usually always a scientific aspect as well. So when you're looking at miracles, the Vatican has a congregation for the causes of saints, and that congregation is responsible for investigating miracles that are attributed to the intercession of saints. And so with that, like, they will send teams around the world, you know, to wherever the miracle happened to do that investigation. They will ask for witness testimony. They will actually, you know, if there's some kind of like physical piece that is involved with the miracle, they will do scientific tests. If it was a miraculous healing, they will look at the previous medical records before and after the healing, conduct their own medical examinations. And so there is a whole, it's a very all-encompassing investigation into the miracles that are performed to make sure this actually is a miracle, to try to rule out any natural causes for things. But then, you know, once they come to a conclusion that there is in fact something supernatural happening, then they will actually, you know, put the stamp and say, yeah, this is a miracle here. This is something supernatural that happened.
Wow. They have their own little X-Files that go out and investigate.
Pretty much. Yeah.
Is that the same with like an exorcism? Is performing a successful exorcism, is that a miracle?
Well, I wouldn't say it's exactly a miracle. Exorcism is a very complicated process. And this is the thing too, is that every exorcist is a priest, but not every priest is an exorcist. So just to put that out there. Exorcism is a very particular ministry. And we call it really a ministry of healing, first and foremost, because the whole idea is to heal somebody who has been afflicted by the demonic. And then we also differentiate between major exorcisms and minor exorcisms. Minor exorcisms can be performed by your average priest, can be performed by certain lay people. And there's even certain minor exorcisms associated with like the sacraments. But then we also have major exorcisms as well, which most people are familiar with as the rite of exorcism. And that is a whole process, you know. And before, you know, the designated exorcist for a diocese would go in to do an exorcism, several things do have to happen first. The first thing is that if a case is reported that could perhaps use exorcism, where you might suspect that you could use it, there's a whole investigative process that involves that. So they send in, like, an exorcist will have a team. He will not be by himself. That team normally consists of, first of all, lay people who have a gift of intercessory prayer and healing prayer, like Sister Breach McKenna, would also have medical doctors as well. So that would include psychologists, psychiatrists, your MDs, physical doctors, you know. And so they look at every single possible aspect of a person's case just to make sure they're not schizophrenic or, you know, or delusional, or, you know, there's nothing wrong mentally there. And then to look at the cases present, you know. So like, for example, if somebody, you know, if you have a small girl, a small child, who might be possessed. And, you know, if you have six grown men sit on this child's chest to hold them down during a manifestation, and they're able to throw off all six men, obviously that's a supernatural strength that should not be present in a normal, let's say, six-year-old girl or something, you know. So there is a whole investigative process before it goes all the way up to the bishop, who then gives his approval for the rite of exorcism to actually take place.
Wow. How often do exorcisms happen? Have you heard of one in the U.S. anytime recently?
I don't know of any particular cases myself. It's a very kind of, not to say secretive thing, but it's very, you know, it's not something you hear all the time. I'm not too sure of the frequency. I would say that the frequency of the exorcisms would probably be on the rise, because I see a lot more people turning to new age, or as we would say in the church, occult practices. That would open people up to demonic activity. And we've seen this in the last, you know, couple of decades, to where the Vatican led an initiative a few decades ago for every single diocese in the world, and even like the USCCB, the United States Conference of Catholic Bishops, wanted an exorcist in every single diocese, at least in the U.S. And wow. So there's a very famous story of when this was happening. There's a priest exorcist, Father Gary. I'm drawing a blank on his last name right now, but he's an exorcist out in California, and who actually went to Rome to take a course in exorcism. And part of the course was actually apprenticing under an exorcist in Rome. And so he went and he did this. And and there was actually an author who basically wrote a book about Father Gary's experiences doing all these things. And that book was made into a movie called The Rite, which is, you know, the R-I-T-E, R-I-T-E, The Rite. And there's a lot of Hollywood liberties taken in the movie, but it's loosely based on Father Gary's story of when he trained in Rome as an exorcist. And so from what my understanding is, there's a great concentration of exorcists in Italy, which is one of the most Catholic countries on the face of the earth, if not the most Catholic, because it's where the Vatican is. But there's a lot of occult practices that happen in Italy, across Europe, but especially like in Rome itself. Because again, Rome has a history of being an amalgamation of cultures. That's what the Roman Empire did. As they conquered people, they would appropriate their customs. And so they took a lot of pagan customs in, a lot of customs that just have still been trickling down through the centuries. And so Rome does have a lot of occult activity. And so with that, there's a high concentration of exorcists in Rome. Here in Louisiana, especially like New Orleans is known for voodoo,
right?
Because of the Creole culture, a lot of the Caribbean voodoo that was brought over. And so there's a lot of demonic activity even that happens in New Orleans. In fact, this is something that really kind of tugs at my heart when I visit St. Louis Cathedral in New Orleans. I mean, St. Louis is iconic, you know, for New Orleans. And it's right there on the riverfront, in the middle of the French Quarter. And when you walk outside the doors of St. Louis Cathedral Basilica, there's all kind of fortune tellers, palm readers, tarot card readers right there, right outside the church. And because like once you walk into the square, that's public land, you can't bar them from being there. It's a public square. And so what happens is they try to get all these tourists who come to see the church to then come get their palms read or, you know, the tarot cards, all these things. And so because New Orleans is full of things like that, I would suspect there's a lot of demonic activity because of the voodoo, because of all these occult practices, where there's probably at least one, if not two, exorcists in just the Archdiocese of New Orleans.
Yeah, that's very, I was going to ask you about voodoo. So, you know, I think a lot of times when you hear people talk about anything related to magic, voodoo, witchcraft, whatever it might be, and there's some differences in these things, if you want to get into the technicalities, it always still goes back to some form of coven. Does that exist in voodoo? Does someone who practices voodoo hang out with other people that practice voodoo? Does this become a church in a way or a cult?
I really don't know. I'm not the most well-versed in terms of voodoo. And I would imagine that somebody who is an exorcist would probably, because you have to know your enemy. I would imagine that an actual exorcist, and again, I'm not an exorcist. So I would imagine they would probably know more about that information. I would imagine so. I mean, it had to have been passed down some kind of way. You have to pick a voodoo some kind of way. I would imagine you have to learn it from somebody, you know? So, when it comes to things like magic, you know, we could make some differentiations, but, the church does not really, you know, I know there's in some aspects of like, even like Wicca and things like that, a differentiation between black magic and white magic. For the church, there is no difference. Magic is magic. And in Catholicism, we would say that all magic is bad. And the right. reason for that is, you know, we look at magic, whether it be white or black magic, as trying to attain two specific things, namely power and knowledge, which is not ours to have. In a way, it's trying to play God, is trying to force things into our own, you know, according to our will, as opposed to surrendering to God's will, is trying to invoke knowledge that we shouldn't have and really don't need. And powers for the same reason. It really subverts faith and trust in God. And so that's why the church doesn't differentiate between different types of magic, or even knowledge, you know, supernatural knowledge. That's why Gnosticism is a huge problem for the church, the sense of knowledge, secret knowledge. and the attainment of secret knowledge. You know, it really does not allow for surrender to the will of God.
Right, right. Well, let's get to a popular conspiracy theory that's out there. It's been all over the internet forever, and that's that the Catholic Church is a cult. So I want to just put this out there. So there's a formula that exists, right? Cult plus time equals religion, right? So I want to go back. I want you to give everyone a history lesson here, and let's go back in time to Jesus and the apostles, okay? So the early church starts here. And a whole lot of churches start from these people, but there were already some major religions happening in the world. Could some say those first 12 members constitutes a cult and it grew from there? Will you address that? And once and for all, let's put this to bed.
Again, it goes back to our different definitions of what a cult is. Based on your definition had mentioned something about like being harmful to people, or what was it? Remind me your definition again.
Whether people thought it was strange or odd.
In the very beginning, yes, you had a lot of devout Jews who thought it was either strange or odd or just downright false, because that's the whole reason the Pharisees kept persecuting the original 12 apostles. That's why the whole reason why St. Paul, before his conversion, was persecuting the early apostles was because he thought this was heresy. He thought this was sacrilege, blasphemy in many ways. And so I would say a lot of people did consider the early church to be a cult. I would say like probably the ancient Romans before Rome as an empire adopted Christianity, probably thought this was its own cult. And so, yeah, I would say there's always accusations that it is a cult. And again, we say that as Catholics, we say that we have a sense of cult in the fact that we have ritual worship. But as opposed to, is this something that is harmful or odd? I mean, we would say this is what God willed.
Right, right. I often wonder if we went back historically, were other religions or governments purposely trying to suppress or crush early religions like this, particularly early Christianity? Was it that bad where it was seek and destroy type of mentality, or was there any kind of acceptance of it?
We see that Rome accepts Christianity after several centuries, after a couple centuries, right? Until the time of Constantine. Before that, you had many emperors who persecuted the church vehemently. And so I think it depends, and I'm thinking really at that time, because what was the major power when Christianity was founded was Rome. And what Rome tended to do was Rome would conquer people and then appropriate a lot of their religions. Look at like the Roman pantheon itself was based off the Greeks. And so it to say that Roman religion was founded in Rome, not quite, the Roman pantheon was based on that of the Greeks. So Rome tended to kind of take aspects of religions that they liked. And I think what really happened with Christianity is that it's a very powerful message. It's a powerful message because, as Jesus would say, like the weak are strong. Blessed are those who are meek, which meekness is not weakness. There's a big distinction. That's a whole nother reflection for another time. But to look at things like the Beatitudes that Jesus is preaching, blessed are you who mourn. Taking all these things that in the eyes of the world would be terrible and finding some kind of power in that because of the power of God, that where we are weak, God is strong and God makes up for that. So I think in many ways, Christianity was threatening to institutions like Rome, and eventually overtook it, that because the fact that Rome was an empire, that became the greatest catalyst for Christianity expanding into all of Europe. At that time, and then even into North Africa and the Middle East, and then of course you had the conflicts with Islam, but that's how Christianity spread. It is such a very powerful message.
So picking up on that, Christianity did spread around the world. It's still to this day the most dominant of the religions, with 52% of the world being Christians, and the highest amount of the percentage of Christians are Catholics. I don't have those numbers in front of me, but the majority of Christians are Catholics. But there's a lot of different Christian religions. that all these all run parallel to each other. So I'm curious to go into this. Would you say that these groups run parallel to one another, or have they become sects of one another in a way? I hear a lot of people joke about Methodists, and they say, well, that's like the light beer of Catholicism, you know? And it's like, it's always funny to hear people discuss or what they get from a different type of Christianity. As a Catholic priest, are these parallel and equal to Catholicism? Are they sects of something else? How would you break down those? And the reason why I'm asking is because once something gets a degree away, it's an offshoot of something, and you get 2 and 3 degrees away from the original person that created the religion. When does it become a cult, or does it, become a sect? It is a sect, just a little bit better version of a cult. You know, do you know what where I'm coming from here?
Yeah.
In terms of the dilution of things.
Right. So that's the thing, the way we would define, like, you know, and we could look at like the history of Christianity to see like, you know, the splits between like, you know, like Catholics and Protestants, you know, that's often like the biggest ones, because you bring them like Methodists, and, you know, so we look at that and how many offshoots there are of each one. We would call those churches ecclesial communities, because for us, we would say that to have a church, you have to have apostolic succession. So you have to have bishops, you have to have sacraments, and you have to have all 7 sacraments. And so many of these Protestant, we call them again, ecclesial communities, are lacking in those things. They don't have apostolic succession, and they don't have 7 valid sacraments. Many of them have valid baptism. So we do recognize them as Christians because many of them have valid baptism. And many of them profess, you know, much of the same thing that was ironed out in the early days of Christianity, the things like the Nicene Creed. You know, many Protestant denominations actually share either the Apostles' Creed or the Nicene Creed. And so by basic profession of that kind of creed, you know, we would say that they are Christians, you know. It's just that, again, we call them ecclesial communities because they're not in communion with the whole church. You know, there's obviously divisions within Christianity. And so that's where we kind of look at that, as opposed to when does it become a cult? I think is when you start to have leaders who probably either a sense of their own, just initiative. Just say, well, I think I'm right, you know, and just go off, you know, in their own direction. And so that's the thing too, is when it comes to the church, you know, we always have to say there's the sense of obedience, first and foremost to Christ as the head of the church, but then also obedience to the bride, you know. And this is, you know, we hear Jesus talk about the church as bride, you know. This is language that St. Paul reflects on a lot in his epistles, that, you know, referring to the mystery of Christ and the church as a husband loves his bride. And so if we say that church is mother, we say Holy Mother Church, then if we're going to be obedient to Christ as head, then we should also be obedient to the mother as well. And so I think a lot of this has to do with the sense of obedience, or maybe the lacking of obedience, as to when maybe some of these offshoots become either sects or cults or, you know, things of that nature.
Where I want to go with this, why I'm curious about this, is I want to go into maybe just a couple specific cases as we get close to the tail end of the podcast here.
Yeah.
So the first one I want to bring up is the Waco siege with David Koresh and the Branch Davidians. So the Branch Davidians were a sect of the Seventh-day Adventists. So the Seventh-day Adventists, they have 28 fundamental beliefs, and just a couple of the highlights of their beliefs are that they do believe in the Holy Scriptures. They believe in the Trinity. They believe in God the Father. They believe in God the Son, and so on and so on and so on. So they have 28 core beliefs, and they celebrate their services on Saturdays. So that's why they're the Seventh-day Adventists. And there's a whole lot. I'm not going to get into a huge description of what the Seventh-day Adventists are, but the Branch Davidians were more of a localized branch of that, but a little bit different, and the rules were a little bit different. And then David Koresh actually kind of expanded on that even himself, and added in his own rules in his own community, and what became, you know, that the notorious cult where nearly everyone died. And there's a whole lot that can be said about Waco, and there will be a future cult following episode all about the Waco siege and where the government went wrong, where the new religious movement went wrong, where Koresh as a person went wrong, all that. We can cover all that. But this is what my point is about how you start to move away enough from the core church, and then we wind up with something that becomes a cult like this. Does that make sense to you? Will that kind of thing continue to happen, do you think, as the world moves on and maybe things get diluted more, or someone who's unhappy in the church says, well, I'll go up and start my own version of this?
Yeah, I mean, it, you know, I think that only gets worse as time goes on, you know, to say that we get further and further away from the truth, you know, because people will always dilute it. I think with the amount of media that there is, and I know like fake news has been a big term the last couple of years. And I think that's part of it, is the fact that people can kind of put whatever they want on the internet or on social media as their own truth. As long as you can somehow convince people that you're right, yeah, people will follow you, you know? And so it's, yeah, I think this is something that will only continue to get worse. I don't see this getting any better. You know, I know people who will say in response to that, well, come Lord Jesus, you know, let the second coming come now and, you know, save us from all that. And, you know, but yeah, I think it's very much possible today that people can still fall for something like that.
Yeah. Another example of this I wanted to bring up was, let's talk about like Mel Gibson's church in Malibu. Okay. He started his own traditional Catholic church. And so it's really sort of an independent thing. It's actually a private church. It's a members only situation. He wants the Latin Mass. The archdiocese in LA don't acknowledge what he does there. He's one of only two churches that are like this in that area. Are these in, can't anyone start a Catholic church? Is that what's happening here? Like, I could go start a Catholic church tomorrow if I wanted to and just not be part of the diocese. Is that possible? Is that totally against the rules?
That's not at all how that, yeah, it is totally against the rules. Absolutely. Yeah. Because the whole idea is, even like the priests have to get faculties from the bishop. And that's the thing, is the bishop has to be in communion with Rome. There's a whole polity here. And this is where, like, you go back to writers like Saint Ignatius of Antioch. So I talked about Ignatius of Loyola earlier with the Sermon of Spirits. My other favorite Ignatius is Ignatius of Antioch, and wrote letters about like the need for union with the bishop. That was huge for him. And so for Ignatius of Antioch, like, yeah, he says, and he stresses this, do nothing outside of union with the bishop. And so, yeah, this is obviously a break in kind of the sense of unity of the church. You can't just go start your own Catholic church. It doesn't work like that. You know, and we saw this with the Society of St. Pius X, where you had Archbishop Lefebvre, who ordained his own bishops, which he can't do. A bishop can't just ordain bishops of his own volition. He has to have, you know, the bishops have to be appointed by the Pope. And then from there, you know, he has to have permission to ordain these bishops, and he didn't do that. So this is very, very, you know, we would say this is out of union with the church.
So it shouldn't be called a Catholic church at all. No. The term Catholic should be dropped from the name of this church.
Right. And because the priest would also have to have faculties from the bishop to celebrate sacraments.
So how do we consider a church like this? Maybe nothing necessarily bad is happening at Mel Gibson's church, but, what are we supposed to treat it? Do we call it a cult? Do we call it a sect? Do we just try to turn a blind eye to it, say it doesn't exist, it's not real, what you're going to isn't really a church?
No, I think what the church tries to do, and again, I find this a very similar situation with organizations like the SSPX, is to try to bring them back into the fold, you know, to engage them in dialogue and to say, okay, like, we know you want valid sacraments, we know you want good liturgy, and this is where, you know, this is where, like, Pope Benedict the 16th, you know, really wanted to, this is the goal he wanted to achieve when he kind of reinstituted, you know, more guidelines to allow more free celebration of the Latin Mass. And then from there, like, that was the goal, was to bring organizations and churches like Mel Gibson's back into the fold of the church. You know, but then at the same time, like, you know, they can't just do this individually. They can't just, you know, go off on their own as offshoots. Like, it's just, you know, we would just recognize them as just not valid churches.
We see this recently with the traditional Latin Mass and how kind of it's come down from the top that that's not supposed to be performed, yet there are still churches that are doing this. You know, are they part of this? Are they not part of this? There seems to be a lot of people that have been resistant to the modernization of the church, that Second Vatican Council. Why are people so resistant to the Second Vatican Council? What do they like so much about before versus after? What is the contention here?
So in terms of in this thing, because I do celebrate both the Latin Mass and the Novus Ordo Mass, the Mass of Vatican II, when it comes to at least, you know, the liturgy itself, the two common things I hear from people that they prefer the Latin Mass is for reverence and beauty. And so when I look at that, it, in my mind as a priest who celebrates both, there's no reason why the Novus Ordo can't be both reverent and beautiful. Again, at that point, the onus is on those of us responsible for the celebration of liturgy to actually make it reverent and beautiful. I think a lot of people, and that's the thing too, I think a lot of people need to actually read the documents of Vatican II. There were many documents that came out of it. It wasn't just a conference to or a council to reform the liturgy. You know, only one of the dogmatic constitutions that came out of Vatican II was on the liturgy, Sacrosanctum Concilium. There were several other dogmatic constitutions that came out of that council. And so I think a lot of it is maybe just, you know, a sense of you know, it was such a revolutionary time, you know, because the church is trying to ask itself, what is the place of the church in the modern world? And so I think it's easy for people to slap a label of, you know, the church is succumbing to modernism simply by, you know, instituting something like Vatican II. And I don't think that's the case at all, you know, because when you actually study and read the documents, what the church is asking for, the questions that it's actually trying to answer are valid questions. You know, it's valid concerns because things were not perfect before the Latin Mass. If the Latin Mass was a perfect Mass, you know, then it wouldn't need to be reformed. So the idea is that, you know, we're trying to engage, how do we continue to make, you know, again, to address the question of what is the church's role in the modern world and how do we evangelize? Because things change. As the culture changes, we have to figure out how do we dialogue with this culture? And so I think that's what a lot of it has to do. It's not solely on the liturgy. A lot of this has to do with, you know, where are we? What's our place? And how do we continue to evangelize? Because what we were doing before is not working now.
Right. Wow. Well, the last thing that I have here that I want to ask you about is I want to talk about Jim Jones for a minute. And okay. For people who aren't familiar with Jim Jones founded a controversial, he actually founded a legitimate church that turned into a controversial destructive cult that ended in the mass suicide of all of the parishioners, nearly all the parishioners, and the murder of a U.S. congressman. But I want to get into just a little bit about Jones's character early on. Jones was Pentecostal. That's what he was into. He became Pentecostal, and he had a desire to preach. So he became ordained as a Christian minister in the Assemblies of God church. And one of the things that's very interesting about Jim Jones historically is Jim Jones started the first integrated church in Indianapolis. This was a time when blacks and whites were in different churches. And Jim was actually looked at as a really respectable local minister. He was very popular and he was very charismatic and he was a good looking guy. He had all those qualities that would make the cult leader later on. But what wound up happening was that Jim Jones would move his ministry to Africa, and they would build a community and build a site, and all the things that go wrong in these places went wrong. You know, he takes all the money from everyone. People emptied out their bank accounts, gave all their possessions to him. There was corruption within his ministry in Africa. He had a lot of relationships with a lot of different people. People that were high up in his congregation were, abusing different women, men and women in the church. And eventually, when it looked like the U.S. government would start to respond to this and come in and maybe bring Jim back into the country, or he would face some charges of some sort, it's where Drink the Kool-Aid came from. They Yeah. distributed Kool-Aid that was poison to the entire congregation, and they all died. They were all found. And there's been a lot of movies about this, been a lot of press about this. So I think what I'm curious about, to a priest, how does a man like this fall so far from being an upright member of the community in Indianapolis, doing things that were unheard of at that time, integrating these churches, putting people together, probably something was very unpopular, to being a man who essentially sentences his congregation to death. What has to be going on with a person like that? You yourself as a priest, you can't ever imagine yourself doing that, ever falling that way, I imagine. But what would have to go on with someone like that to have that happen?
I think it goes back to that sense of obedience I mentioned earlier. Because on our end as a priest, like, and this is the same way for the Pope, is that in the sense of obedience, you know, we are expected as priests to have a spiritual director. You know, even the Pope has a spiritual director, you know, and then that spiritual director also has a spiritual director. Every single priest has another priest for spiritual direction. And it's all, this is really like checks and balances. The role of a spiritual director is to help the person they are directing to discern what is the will of God for that person's life. And so if someone just up and says, well, I feel like God is calling me to do whatever Jim Jones did, you know, if he felt that way, I would imagine he did not have a spiritual director who said, you know what, maybe this just sounds a bit strange, or let's just say outright crazy to have his congregation commit suicide. You know, so I think that would happen first. That would certainly enable somebody to do something like that, is to not have any kind of checks and balances. I'm going to quote the movie Chernobyl, or not the movie, the HBO series Chernobyl. Where the director of the KGB says that the KGB is a giant circle of accountability, that even somebody is responsible for following the director of the KGB. You know, same thing in a way with the church. I'm not saying the church is communist, not at all, not by any means, but that sense of accountability, where like every priest has a spiritual director, that director has a director, and so on and so forth, right? That if someone is completely autonomous, that if they believe that God is telling them to go do something like this, there's no one to stop and say, this is obviously not the will of God, right? Again, against everything that the church professes and believes. And then again, on top of that, I think having to go back to looking at psychological profiles, you know, is this person schizophrenic, or, you know, that's what we're, I think what would enable something like that to happen is somebody who really was just absolutely convinced this is what they were supposed to do. And I would look at those particular avenues to say, you know, that's how it's possible.
The root of the cult following podcast is about the psychology of the followers of a cult and the psychology of the leader of a cult. And what I usually am the most interested in is not necessarily what you get at the end when you hear about the tragedy of it all, how it all went to crap, but the magical stew that made it all. You know, that's the interesting thing. And I wonder, in the case of Jim Jones, the kind of power that he had over his congregation is one of the things I find really fascinating. It's not like he moved to a bigger building across town. He went to Africa and everyone went with him like that.
Right.
What I mean, wow, the power that minister has to have to just say, hey guys, guess what? I got some land in Africa. We're going to move the congregation there. It's not like saying, you know, I got some land in Oklahoma. We're going to move from Indiana to Oklahoma. That would be a big move for a lot of people to follow your minister to another state, much less to another country.
Continent.
How would you define that? What kind of hold does he have? Was he that good of a minister that he was able to do that? Were his parishioners just, you know, were they drinking the Kool-Aid way before they were drinking the Kool-Aid? What do you think about that?
I think in many ways it could be a sense that he was very charismatic, perhaps, and then also perhaps preaching into specific wounds of people, inner wounds. And when people feel some kind of hope that that wound is going to be healed or the hole that they have is going to be filled, I think that's what would motivate somebody to follow somebody like that. Look at Hitler, for example. I mean, Hitler had convinced all, you know, a great majority of Germany to commit the atrocities that Germany did, you know, because why? He was charismatic, and what he promised was a sense of healing, a sense of hope, a sense of a future restored for Germany, you know. And so if that's the thing that people can preach, you know, if people believe that they can achieve that through this person's preaching, then that's probably what would make somebody follow somebody like that, you know. Yeah. That's the thing is, you know, it's not so even so much on an intellectual level as it is maybe on an emotional and psychological level, you know, a person searching for needs that they want filled.
Well, you know, the preacher is very powerful. I'm a big fan of the Old West, everything Old West, right? And I often think it's really interesting when I research a lot of Old West towns about how powerful the preacher in the town was, that oftentimes the preacher was more powerful than the law.
Yeah.
Because what the preacher said, people, everyone's listening to, but not everyone's listening to what the sheriff says. And I think it's really an interesting dynamic of how that's evolved over time, that influence.
Yeah.
For sure. But anyways, Father Dan, I'm glad that we could get together and do this. I hope we presented some interesting things for people to think about.
Metacortex Publishing hopes that you've enjoyed this presentation.
Please take a moment to listen to some other podcast offerings from Metacortex Publishing.
A quest is a search for something. And every week, the Quest podcast will show you how we know what we know through interviews with people that have incredible stories of dedication and perseverance. I'm your host, Todd Fisher. Join me in this thought-provoking and inspiring podcast of discovery. Find us anywhere you listen to podcasts.
The No Earthly Explanation podcast investigates the things that are unexplainable. Hosted by world-renowned investigative researcher Donald R. Schmidt and scientist Ellie Ringo, follow them as they look for evidence for things that have no earthly explanation. Available anywhere you listen to podcasts.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. Please be sure to rate and review this episode. This podcast is produced by Todd Fisher and Anthony Smith and is distributed by Metacortex Publishing. This podcast is copyright. Any previously trademarked or copyright content is used by permission. Information and opinions stated in this podcast should not be construed as medical advice. Please be sure to visit the official website for Metacortex Publishing at metacortexpublishing.com or find us on social media for other unique content.